Hello, everyone. Welcome to the second episode of 4J's in a Comic.
Woo!
We promise that this one will be better than the first one.
We promise they'll get progressively better.
That's a pretty huge bar, man.
Not starting it at 1 in the morning is probably a better idea.
After a 16-hour day.
Yeah.
You were up how early getting that brisket ready?
Well, I had about 2.5 hours of sleep, so that's why I sounded tired on the first episode.
Tired, stoned, whatever.
So with us, I'm John Harder again from Waterfront Comics.
Hey, man. Nice to meet you.
And with us, we have Joe Vicious.
Hi there.
And JP from Panda Manga.
What's up?
Yeah, and Justin from every podcast done in the 707 and mainly askametalhead.com, which has gotten a new
co-host, right?
Yeah. I brought in a buddy of mine named Brian. We used to play in a band together, so you'll get a little bit
metal
more.
Cred.
Total metal cred, great guitarist, listens to a completely different type of sort of metal than I do. Like, I like really heavy stuff, and he likes more sort of mainstream, hard rock,
heavy
metal.
You get a little bit of a combo there.
Yeah, so now you have, me as a musician listening to it from sort of the, the rhythm section, him listening to it from sort of, the leads and guitarist sort of perspective, and then my kids, which are just, they're just huge fans, so.
Right. Awesome.
They're just kids.
Just kids. Yeah, that's good. That's a good cross-section. Awesome. Yeah.
So
tonight, our topic will be kaiju, which are giant f***ing monsters.
With
the literal Japanese
translation. That is the actual Japanese translation.
Kaiju. They do not wear yarmulkes, I found out. That was a surprise.
We are doing this tonight before Pacific Rim opens. We will be seeing the movie tomorrow night, and it will be up on our quickie movie review podcast.
Yes. Yeah, we'll put it up on pandamanga.com. And that will be fun. We've been looking forward to it for a long time.
Mm. Yes.
Which is more than we can say about the other movies we've done so far this summer.
Recent memory, yeah.
Someone we've been dreading for a long time.
Exactly.
What if Silver was a giant robot horse?
Would have been awesome.
Yeah. And it made the movie make a lot more sense.
Yeah. What is that horse on my roof suddenly? He's giant.
What I want to know about Pacific Rim is if they're going to like have a mecha Godzilla kind of thing. Because that's what the humans do in Godzilla is eventually they go like, "F this, man. We're going to actually be like, no, we're not going to keep shooting stuff at it because that's not working. Let's make a Godzilla." It's like a big metal Godzilla.
Yeah. Right.
Don't they make it out of the bones?
The bones of a Godzilla, yeah. Right? And then, of course, it awakens and starts to fight them. It's all this big mess. The humans just can't win in these poor kaiju movies.
More so tiny. Yeah. I wonder what the Japanese word for the total reverse of kaiju is, like little tiny miniaturized
Pokemon
robots. It would be like, would you rather fight 10 duck-sized horses or one horse-sized duck? Would you rather fight 10 poodle-sized kaiju or one? I think I would go for the poodle-sized kaiju.
Yeah, any day.
The little tiny ones, So.
So the comics we're reviewing are?
First, we're going to be reviewing the Pacific Rim prequel graphic novel that was actually written by the screenwriter, Adam Beecham. And then next we'll be talking about Godzilla in comics, and we'll be reviewing Godzilla Gangsters and Goliaths that came out from IDW in 2011.
I really enjoyed that one.
Yes.
I was surprised at how many different Godzilla comics there are. I think we all kind of expect for there to be like 30 different books that the X-Men are in at one time, but Godzilla, as awesome and geeky as Godzilla is as a subject, it seemed a little obscure comic-wise to me, anyway.
Yeah, at least in American comics.
Right, but come over here, and you come into the shop, and there's like 3 or 4 different ones, and then in the trays, don't even get me started. They just go and go.
And we'll talk about that in the second half of the show.
Yeah, interesting.
First, for a little housekeeping, last week we talked about Greg Rucka leaving the Big Two to go to do creator-owned comics.
Mm-hmm.
And earlier this week, some news broke that George Perez, who is an industry legend, and the Teen Titans Go cartoon, basically he was responsible for creating most of those characters.
Wow.
Cyborg, Starfire, Raven, all those were created by him and Marv Wolfman in the 80s. And I can say without that comic, the store probably wouldn't exist, as that was what got me into reading comics.
Really?
Wow. Yeah. Oh,
interesting.
So, industry legend, made DC Comics probably millions and millions and millions of dollars throughout the year. And he left DC to go to work for a small company called Boom Comics, whose probably best known now for publishing the Adventure Time and Regular Show mm-hmm. comics. Left them because he was able to get a better creative package and to actually get regular staff benefits.
Wow, really?
I don't know if Warner Brothers can't afford to pay their employees health benefits or not, but it just shows where the industry's kind of starting to go, where a legend in the field has to go to a smaller company in order to be creative.
It's so strange, too, because, you know, growing up reading comics, you idealize all these guys. You see the names on the, you know, see the cover of the yeah. comic books, and you go, oh, man, that guy must be awesome. His life must be amazing. He must be with just cars and women and money and, you know. Mm-hmm. And then you actually go to a convention or a panel, and you meet these guys, and they're like, my work is so hard.
I work for, give me money.
Get for 16 hours a day. I never see the light.
I they think give I me have something. Children somewhere.
I just, you know, oh, it's so hard. You know, it's like, I mean, I don't mean to overblow it. I mean, they enjoy their work, otherwise they wouldn't do it. But so much of the time, it's a little disillusioning to really hear them talk about their actual lifestyle and their real routine of the unbelievable, huge, hard amount of work that they do, and that they really don't get properly compensated for it.
And it's such a solitary lifestyle, being in front of a drawing board for hours and hours at a time. You know that from yourself, from being an artist.
Oh, yeah, and I can't, I mean, and my, I'm so slow in comparison to these pros. I can't even imagine, you know, the amount of work that they do is insane. I mean, it's so much.
So with that being said, it's be interesting to see what's starting to come out from him down the road from Boom, and, you know, nice to see, you know, an older in quotation marks that you can't see on the podcast, getting a chance to do some quality work.
That's exciting. That's exciting. Can we assume that it's going to be more from left field and creative than
they really haven't said what it's going to be yet? So
it'll be fun to see what happens.
He has done some creator own work in the past, very sci-fi heavy, the stuff that came out, but who knows?
Cool. Very cool.
All right. Now on to Pacific Rim.
What? So excited about this movie. I enjoyed this book. I really liked it a lot, actually.
As I bring it back to the nerd thing, like I always end up doing, what I thought was very interesting is Legendary Comics put out the book, who's it's a Legendary Films production,
right?
Which is distributed by Warner Brothers that owns DC Comics, but yet Marvel distributes the Legendary Comics line, so it's kind of like a circle, and I'm like, how does that work?
It sounds like a big mess. I was kind of surprised because I looked at the cover and I thought to myself, after, you know, getting a little ways into it, I thought, wait, who's publishing this? And I looked at it, I said, Legend? They're a movie company. What's going on? I was totally assuming that somebody would have been publishing it that would be more recognizable. I mean, does Legend publish much aside from just their movie properties?
They've put out about 3 books so far.
All based on their movies?
No, the first one was a Frank Miller graphic novel that had languished in obscurity. And it was originally started out as a Batman project, but then he went insane, and it wouldn't work for Batman, so he made a Batman-like character and a Catwoman-like character.
Nice.
Oh, yeah, what was that? I just saw it on your shelf today. What was that called?
It's called...
No, it's
as we look over our shoulder.
Yeah. Holy Terror. Holy Terror is what it's called, and it's basically his take on 9/11 and terrorism and... And then they did that, and then they did Matt Wagner and Simon Beasley project called Geist Talk that will be coming, that the first 4 book series finished up. And then you got Pacific Rim. So
you might wonder if this is the natural evolution of that medium, you know, companies like Legendary, these other movie companies, probably it's much easier for them to develop their own content, even in that medium, you know, even in a comic book format. And then make a movie out of it rather than pay some, like buy the license, right?
Well, it seems like a trend that you're seeing over and over again is that the movie companies, which I don't think is really fair objectively, but a lot of people would, I guess, in layman's terms, assume is the ultimate form of expressing some kind of a creative story. I don't agree with that.
I don't either.
Yeah, but I think that it's probably safe to say that a lot of people kind of be like, well, when are they coming out with a movie? Because that means that you've really arrived, you know, most of the time, conventionally.
Yeah.
Anyway.
I was having a discussion with John Foltz.
Really?
About his books. And when he tells family members or people he grew up with, they're like, oh, this would be such a great TV show. And he's like, no, it's a book. I wrote it as a book.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Yes, but we don't want to take the time to read it. So
yeah.
Turn it on the TV.
What I was going to say is that I've been hearing that it seems like a lot of the time the movie companies are becoming less and less adventurous about picking up new properties and checking out different kinds of unknown scripts, and that they're being much more conservative. They like to see if something's going to be popular anyway. So that's one of the reasons why we're seeing so many comic book movies, is that they go, well, let's see what's already popular and let's make a movie out of that, because then we have
it's me too.
Yeah. So we have a, well, not only that, but they have a built in fan base. And if they, at least up until the movie comes out, make it seem like they're going to do it justice, then all of the fans of the comic book will do free advertising for them. Because right. I tell you what, if someone's going to come out with a Starman book, John's going to be like, holy shit, everybody, Starman movie, woo!
We're having a viewing party at the shop.
Exactly. Yeah. And so, you know, regardless of whether or not it ends up being good in the end, up until the point where John has seen it and has an opinion about it, John's going to be excited about it. He's going to be telling people about it. And John's not the only one. And so any title that we as comic book fans are excited about, we're going to be advocates for. And so it's kind of this lazy but brilliant thing that Hollywood is doing these days. And it's really hard, I understand, as a screenwriter to come up with some random brand new idea and then start pitching it around like they used to do traditionally. They're getting really conservative. They like to wait to see if something's already popular.
Of course, you're also seeing a lot more of the inverse, too, is the anything that sells big in the box office, they're doing book adaptations, they're doing comic adaptations.
Sure.
Seeing a lot of comic adaptations.
But that's kind of how it's always been. There's always been tie-in movies, tie-in comics, tie-in novels for everything that's popular. I think it's interesting to see things are going the other way, because so much of the time you're getting original material in the film, you know, along with obviously some adaptations, but adaptations were not in any way the majority, but it seems like it's heading the other way.
That's actually one of the things I really liked about the Pacific Rim was it was an adaptation of a movie, but it's actually a tie-in piece to it.
Oh, it's canon.
Yeah, it's canon in there.
There are characters in this that are developed in this that you see in the movie.
I read a quote from Adam Beeching where the movie fit in. When we watch Pacific Rim tomorrow, we'll see the kaiju destroying the Golden Gate Bridge as they first come, and then a black title screen 15 years later, and that will be the movie we watch, where the graphic novel fills in the gap of that 15 years. Mm-hmm. So basically, in the graphic novel, we're seeing how the mechs, which they called Jaegers.
Yeah. Jaegers.
Like a Jaeger bomb.
Yeah, which means hunter, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. Means hunter.
I just learned something. How the Jaeger program starts and why you need two pilots for each one and... Mm-hmm.
Yeah, two pilots for the bridge to work, pawns bridge.
Right, pawns. Which, that's, for me, that's really more one of the more interesting focuses of the novel, or the book is it's less about the battles and fighting and giant robots and giant, you know, demonic, whatever they are, big giant lizard things.
The kaijus.
Mm-hmm. Kaiju, that's right.
And it's a lot about the why we fight, which is what the reporter is going around.
Yeah, the way they went about.
And the relationships and stuff, so...
I love that the through line reminds me of World War Z, right?
I was thinking that when we read it.
Yeah, totally. So the through line throughout this whole thing is basically a reporter going around and talking to different key people, very much like World War Z, talking to different key people that were involved at different stages where, you know, they first figured out the idea of having the Jaegers, then the breakthroughs in how to make them actually work, and then a couple of the first very successful pilots, people who went on to become the trainers for people who are going to be doing the Jaegers. And it's so cool because it's such a great way to connect so many different strings of story logically, is to have somebody go through and their job is to talk to all these different people that have, and to get access to all these people that had key parts in the story and in the world, where normally, if it's just one person's perspective, most of the time, one person isn't realistically going to have that almost omniscient ability to have access to all these different people and all these different stories. But you can still follow one person if they're, after the fact, a reporter. It's brilliant. It's one of the reasons why World War Z is so brilliant. I think that's one of the neatest things about this book is that you get such a really good, clear picture of kind of the global scale of everything.
Right. It's as if you did it the other way around, listening to one person talk, you would get the outline but no color. Yeah. And this gives you,
the depth of story from one of the people that she talks to, but only from that person's
perspective, right? So,
yeah.
But it also it adds so much more to the storytelling. For example, one of the guys, he doesn't have a family. He ends up adopting like the last survivor from Tokyo. Like Tokyo's obliterated. There's one survivor. There's
little girl, which is I think she's the chick that ends up being opposite the main character in the movie. Do you think?
We'll find out.
Yeah,
we'll see.
Because in the end, towards the end of this, they're talking about her wanting to be a Jaeger pilot. Yeah.
Right.
Sneaking suspicion.
Little foreshadowing.
Just a wee bit.
Yeah.
John, what did you think of the story of this one?
I really liked it. Like you said, I thought using the reporter to get the stories through.
Brilliant.
I liked I forget the character's name, but the one that we played by the guy from Luther.
Oh, right. He's awesome.
And seeing how his sister dies in the first kaiju attack and seeing all the loss that he's gone through.
Right. She's a pilot. Yeah. She takes on one of the kaiju. And
is that going to be Idris Elba?
Yes, that's the name I couldn't remember.
That's the name I can barely
Marshall
pronounce.
Pentecost, that's his name, Pentecost.
That's a great name.
Right?
That's up there with Jack Hammer, isn't it?
Yeah, I am excited about the cast for this movie, for sure. And it's always kind of odd to see real people realized in comic form. It's almost more natural to see a real person dressing up like a comic book character than to see a real person in comic book form.
It kind of has that uncanny valley effect.
It does. But that was one thing that did not throw me about this. They were able to go about it in such a way that it looked enough like them that you're like, oh, that's who that's going to be. But it wasn't eerie. They managed to kind of stay a few paces back from that uncanny valley, and it really worked well. I was impressed, because that's one thing that I was concerned about.
So when this was written, was the cast already chosen? Did they already know?
Oh, yeah. Well, I don't know whether it was written, but most definitely when it was drawn.
He knew that.
This has been in production for a long time.
Because it's the screenwriter, the story he couldn't fit into the movie.
Gotcha.
That was one thing that I wanted to touch on. And I often say this, but if you're listening to this, maybe you don't listen to Geek Life, so you can hear it for the first time. I am in love with stories that have such a big, robust world that you don't need to show everything to be able to tell a good story. I like the idea of the world being this rich collage, and you're looking through a little viewfinder, and you see a small piece of it. And there's this magnificent tapestry behind it that supports it and makes it rich and complicated and tethered to all these different through lines and stories and histories, and it just makes it a powerful story. But it's so good, it's such a realized universe that you don't need to show everything to make it an entertaining story. You can show a small piece of it, and there's things that are going to happen that they might gloss over that are just part of the way of life in this world that you're not going to understand, and they're like, too bad, fuck you, you're just not going to know it, because this is how the world works. We're showing you a piece of it. We're not going to try and get down to the nitty-gritty and explain everything. I love stories that do that. And this is what they did here. The story is so big that they could do a whole comic book in it and still not have shown you everything.
That's actually kind of why I didn't like the comic. While we're getting ready for the movie, is because the movie is going to give us a very certain feel. And I think this gives you just a little too much peek behind the curtain.
I see.
Like, it's going to spoil it a little bit. Like, yeah, maybe we're in the movie not going to know exactly how the pawn system works, or all about the original creator, or even the background of the Marshall Pentecost character. But that's going to make them, I don't know, a little more human.
Well, that's what I'm saying, is that's why I like when they do movies that are like that.
Yeah.
And I think that this comic book being available, the material for this comic book being so readily available and so rich, is an expression of a world that's so fully realized. It's a little, it's a little bit odd.
It's kind of like cheating.
It's like reading a Star Wars technical manual before you see the first Star Wars movie for the first time, right?
Yeah. It feels like skipping ahead to the end to read the last page and then reading the book.
I don't know if I agree with you or disagree. I think my biggest concern is that they're going to lose the relationships that this book really strives to develop.
Yeah, and unfortunately, early reviews are looking towards that being a challenge.
So, I mean, I think we're just going to get robot fights, and, you know, I'm hoping that it's not. My biggest concern is that it's not Transformers 4. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I mean that. The first Transformers I thought was really good, after that, you kind of lost me a little bit.
Mm-hmm. I think that we needed to lean into the geek cred that Guillermo del Toro has built up.
Well, yeah, he's an excellent... I mean, Hellboy was really good, and...
Pan's Labyrinth was amazing.
Yes.
I mean, pretty much anything he puts his hands to...
Right, right.
You know, within reason is good.
And then you have the screenwriter writing the graphic novel, the comic.
Sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, my concern is... That was one of the things I really enjoyed about this was there are some distinct relationships that happen, and even, you know, sort of how they accidentally figure out how to efficiently run these gigantic mechs. You know, they start out by trying one person can't handle it, it's too much. Mm-hmm. And just kind of per chance, you know, you get this involvement by one of the scientists who happens to be female, and then there's this internal sort of relationship that sort of happens, and it's even, you know, it's not even necessarily a flowery, wonderful relationship in that there's no, you know, there's another guy involved, and it's sort of, you know, they all work together, and it's like, it's, you're like, wow, this is so real. It's so like, this could be happening in anybody's workplace, you know? And so there's a bit of a love story that just happens to have all of this chaos going around it. And that's what I really liked about it. And I think what we're going to see with the movie is none of that. You'll see, you know, sort of the grizzled veteran, and you kind of get the sense that there's this kind of rogue guy that's, you know, he has to go find and convince to come and fight with him. And you lose the whole why we fight. You know, we fight for love, or we fight for, this is the reason why we fight. Mm-hmm. So I hope that's not what happens. I'm sure it's going to be an amazing visual display, mm-hmm. but I hope that there's some underlying rhythm.
So you're hoping that there's some human drama.
Yeah. I'm sure there will be.
This does a very good job of doing.
Yeah. I'm sure there will be, but you know, I feel like it was really rich in this book.
Yeah. The developing love triangle with Dr. Schoenfeld.
Right.
And Caitlin.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It's really and the Jaeger pilot. I can't remember his name.
I don't remember either.
D'Onofrio, right?
D'Onofrio, yeah.
Although I have to say, for me, that was probably one of the weakest points story-wise. The reason why the Jaegers need two people and how to make it the most powerful is the power of love.
Yeah, right.
Like,
I know.
It's like, oh, really?
But I kind of dug that because it was...
It's the fifth element.
Yeah, but I thought that was...
Son of a bitch. Stop it.
I thought that was interesting because it wasn't some mechanical thing. It was an emotional thing. You know what I mean? And so I like that little...
I just wish it wasn't as on the nose as it is. The character Dr. Schoenfeld, when he's talking to the reporter, mm-hmm. he begins his story saying, it's something that I never could have found. I'm not capable of finding it. And she's like, why? Well, let me tell you. And he goes through this whole story and he nutshells it with, because Caitlin and D'Onofrio were in love and I'm not in love and I couldn't understand it. And so it's not for me. And so what made the Jaegers work is love. And it's like, oh, fuck off. I hate that. You know, it's like, it's one thing if a strong emotional connection makes it more powerful, and maybe a loving relationship between the two Jaeger pilots is what makes the most powerful combination. But it's like, can we not have love be the reason it works at all? It's like, come on.
Well, I don't think that's it because, you know.
Well, I mean, but that's kind of how it came across there. And just, you know, I'm
glad
that.
That's not how I read it.
Okay.
I'm not refuting you.
Sure.
That's what I love about this medium is that you read it and you get something out of it. And that's maybe
I'm kind of looking for that because I hate that shit.
Right. Right. And so, you know, some of this is
not that I'm against love, but I'm just, right.
Yes, you are.
No, I'm not. I'm just against, it just feels cheesy. It's like, how are we going to defeat the monsters? The power of human love.
We have to hug it out.
Like, you know, it's hams across the world. The kaiju will leave us alone. It's like,
the kaiju just really want hugs. I think that's what we're going to see in the movie.
That so much.
The dude's going to get slammed with a giant, what is he? He's got like a tanker. He's going to hit the thing with the tanker and it's going to be like,
that looks so great. I got goosebumps when I saw that.
Yeah, that was pretty cool. But, you know, then there's the guy in me that's like, that tanker would totally break up. There's no way that would possibly work. But anyway, I'm going to let it go.
Right. Anyway, so you didn't read that though.
What I read it as is he's trying to, you know, he's trying to develop a weapon. And it never crossed his mind, really, that the one thing that would make it work was this, you know, sort of this dynamic of love. And it really is an interesting parallel in the sort of like love and war. And, you know, that. So that's kind of how I read it. I didn't read it that like he couldn't feel love or he wasn't, you know, because he obviously.
Oh, no. I'm just saying my problem was that love was the answer instead of love made it. Like love made it work. But the thing that's nice about that is that later on in the book, they actually have two
brothers.
Brothers.
Right. Mm-hmm.
that it's not romantic love. It's just a strong connection.
Right, right.
And they're when they went there, I was kind of like, oh, all right. And I kind of put my sword away and stopped raging, because that, like, just, I don't know. There's just something about it. It's like it's a great concept, but it feels to me kind of like it feels like an ex machina sort of a moment where it's just like God reaches down and goes, oh, and just fixes it all. It's like, really?
Okay. Go ahead, John.
But later on, with the Eldest Ibra character, mm-hmm. but Marshall Pentecost, his partner, they weren't in love.
Right. I was just going to say
that's what I'm saying. But the very first time, so what I'm saying is that the conversation early on, the conversation early on with Dr. Schoenfeld and the reporter, and his whole preface to the conversation and how he kind of wrapped it up at the end, talking about how the Jaeger program got started and how mm-hmm. they came up with the idea of having the two people, he was asserting that the secret and the answer was love. But then they move on. That's what it felt like to me. And then they moved on, and it's like, wait, no, maybe not. It's, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? It's
two brains operating in sort of a similar pattern.
That was just the idea I got. It was two brains operating that
they have to, but
a connection and have a similar way of thinking.
Right. They have to be, there has to be total symbiosis between the two people. Or
sure. You know. I think what he was, I mean, actually, you know what? Light bulb. In retrospect, I think what he was saying and the reason why he was thinking that, or the reason, not so much the reason why it worked was love, but the reason why they had the breakthrough was love.
Right.
Because
right,
he would have just let that Jaeger pilot by himself with his own brain, with the one brain trying to connect to the robot,
and let him
have
die.
A seizure and die.
Right.
But Caitlin was in love with D'Onofrio, and she was like, no, and did anything she could to try and do it. And that was the
happy accident.
Yeah, the happy accident, that like light bulb moment, you know?
Right.
Like,
that's what I got out of
it. Yeah, okay.
She's in love. She puts herself in peril, and the only way that was going to happen, none of the other dudes standing there were going to jump into the, you know, jump in, and
because she loved him, then okay, all
right, it was a natural, right, it was a natural
I received my angry comments.
It's sort of like, it's like
alone forever
forever alone, John. It's almost like, and I this is a, you have to follow me on this is far, but it's almost like in the movie Signs, where the little girl always leaves glasses of water around. The guy's a bat, and, you know, and they're afraid of water, and so there's glasses of water everywhere, and he's a great bat, a swinger of the bat. And so it's like it all kind of fell together at the end. You're like, well, what are all these random sort of weird, like, why are these relevant, right? If you put it together like that, it sort of, it makes sense. You know? It just had to happen that way.
Yeah.
Just like, how are we going to fight these big kaiju with our military? They're impossible. And then the guy just randomly sees his kid playing with two little figurines. And, you know, then he's like, he has that sort of eureka moment. Well, we'll just build a similar sized robot. So
right, we'll build a Mechagodzilla.
Every time you say Mechagodzilla, man, all I see is the South Park episode with Mecha Streisand and the little Asian guy go, Robo Smith.
So why don't we talk a little bit about the art before we wrap up? Or did we have some more things we wanted to say story-wise?
I think we're all good on story-wise.
Yeah, I did enjoy it. I'm looking forward to the movie even more now.
Yeah.
I thought the art was solid, but not spectacular.
Yeah.
It fits the story well.
Yeah.
I only knew one artist from there. And for me, that's saying something.
Yeah, for you, that's definitely saying something. So an unknown was involved a little bit there. I really like the art. I think that the only thing, it's professional comic book art. It looks really good. I'm used to reviewing indie comic art, and so I can come at it and be all, but I mean, there's not a lot to complain about here. The only thing that spun me a little bit here and there was that sometimes the faces looked a little skewed. Did you guys notice that? Where it's almost like somebody did like a free transform in Photoshop and went and like twisted them a little bit. But that was rare. By far and away, it was really, really good. I do kind of wish that it was a little darker in tone. Because you see the movie and it's like, it's at nighttime and it's raining and it's just rawr, you know, it's just this sort of dark.
Well, I think this is supposed to be the more hopeful of the two parts of the story.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Right, it's the beginning. It's the why we fight, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely kind of have an uplifting sort of a sense. But I think the art was really good. I liked it a lot.
I liked a lot of the creature design.
Right?
The ones that we didn't see in the trailers, like the big wooden one.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Though,
that dude is awesome.
Yeah, though in the fight scenes, it's hard to tell with the art, like, what exactly is happening. A lot of it is kind of obscured.
Yeah, there was a little bit of that. Motion on gigantic creatures seems to get skewed a little bit.
Well, here's probably one of the biggest things that I find is a unfortunate difference between a lot of American comic books and Japanese comic books. Japanese comic books has found that magic sweet spot of having lots and lots of action and motion. Now, maybe it's because they, in my opinion, maybe it's because they rely so heavily on action lines and things like that.
Speed lines.
Yeah, speed lines and things like that. And it's not that those sort of things aren't present in American comics, but I would say it's a whole lot more common for there to be action that looks like a snapshot of the middle of things instead mm-hmm. of has the feeling of motion and movement and vitality that a really good action scene does. And that they do that. They accomplish that very successfully on a very regular basis. But I have noticed over and over again in American comics specifically that that's a more common challenge. Not like a more than half of the comics are like that, but it happens regularly enough to go, this is something that happens in American comics sometimes. And so I don't know if it's a style thing, but there's so much beautiful detail and so clean that it almost looks like somebody took a freeze frame of the shot and it looks like they're frozen in motion instead of actually, I don't know, there's just a loss of that sort of that feeling of movement to me.
I didn't have any problem following the action, and maybe it's because I don't read much manga.
Mm.
And, you know, I read 99.9% American style comics. And
sure.
I thought that the action scenes flowed perfectly well. I really liked the action scene at the beginning when the kaijus first show up at the Golden Gate Bridge and the story about the guy going to rescue his grandfather.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that was great.
Right.
They did such a good job in that scene or in that whole sequence of emphasizing how big they are.
Yeah.
Having them try and escape his little house in Chinatown. Chinatown, right?
Yeah.
And having stuff just exploding around them, and then they do this kind of pan up, almost 3-point perspective sort of shot where they're tiny and there's this giant monster smashing something, and it's just like, it's that like standing next to a giant ship moment where it's just like, damn, I'm very small in comparison.
I had to keep looking at the particular panel where the sister is flying towards the kaiju, and then there's a next, like the next panel over where he kind of swings down and takes her plane out. I had to keep looking at that to try to figure out exactly what was going on.
Yeah.
Because that was really hard for me to read. Like, what is he doing? Yeah, is it his tail? Is it an arm? Is it his mouth? I couldn't tell.
No. In the second fight with the twin brothers, mm-hmm. there were a couple of scenes where they're pulling back one arm to throw a punch, and suddenly the other arm is swinging like a log or something.
But I have to ask, what is a snap line?
Snap
speed line?
Speed line, oh. Yeah.
I mean,
as I'm looking through it, there's a lot of that in here in some of the scenes with the monsters and the action scenes, and they are arguably the most dynamic ones. Mm-hmm. But basically, a speed line would be, let me see if I can find a picture of one.
Is it like that swoosh line?
Yeah,
from,
it's the whoosh okay, line.
I know exactly.
Like behind your fist while you're throwing a punch.
It seems like they're less prominent in this style, where more it's almost like color, or it's, you know, it's hard to explain. It's not just a black line that indicates, you know, that denotes motion. That's
I'm not a big fan of speed lines at all, so
that's, oh really,
yeah.
John's a big fan of speed loaders though, so
I don't even know what that means.
It's a gun term. Speed loader.
For a revolver.
Yeah, for a revolver. All right, so, okay, revolvers have 5 shots, 6 shots, and you can dump, if you fire a revolver, you can dump all the shells out. There's a little lever on the front of the cylinder, and you push that up, and it pops all of the casings out. If you were in the olden days, if you wanted to reload that pistol, you had to literally push each round in one by one, but a speed loader holds them all in this little cylinder-shaped rig, and you just push it in, you know, you line it up, push it in, pop the back off, and now they're all in. All of the shells are loaded in exactly where you need. And then you close the cylinder, and then you're ready to go. Yeah. So it's like loading one bullet, but loading all 6 at the same time. So it's a speed loader.
This is an example of the action lines, the speed lines, that sort of
like his left hand, right?
Well, no. Like all the lines centering mm-hmm. around that focal point.
Right.
Even though it's really artfully done here because it's all done in a variance of color of the background. Mm-hmm. That's nice and tasteful instead of just big black lines everywhere, which sounds like what John doesn't like. But is this more tasteful?
I see it.
Yeah, there's a scene a little ways in here. And
for those of you who can't see this, it's basically a scene of a Jaeger backhanding.
He's bitch slapping a kaiju.
Yeah, he's just smacking it, like ripped his arm off.
And it literally says, wham.
It says, wham. Yeah.
in big giant letters.
So is there anything else you wanted to say about this comic?
I guess the last thing I would say is if somebody doesn't know that this exists and just goes and sees the movie, mm-hmm. they're going to have a completely different experience than we will, because we know that this medium exists, that this extra little piece exists.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this and rounds things out quite a bit.
And even when you buy the DVD Blu-ray, you probably will never see this. Yeah, and so it's an interesting note to see that this is something special for comic book readers. The challenge with that is there's enough meat in this that you almost feel like maybe they're going to get too much of a completely different experience, yeah. right?
And that's exactly what I'm not really digging about this book, is that it's going to change the movie experience dramatically for me.
And sometimes it's good and sometimes it's bad. If you never read...
Depending on how the movie turns out, right. I don't know yet.
I'm going to digress for a second.
Yeah.
When the first J.J. Abrams Star Trek movie came out, IDW had published a 4-issue miniseries called Countdown. And it literally went from how Spock got to the scene where him and Nero come through. And having read that, and then seeing the movie, you know, like, oh, that's cool, because I saw that in the comic. But not seeing it, you have a completely different experience.
But I don't think that it's a worse experience.
No, it's not a worse experience. Yeah. I felt it was a better experience.
Yeah, see, I think the thing that Joe is talking about with reading this and maybe it diminishing the experience, is that what you're saying?
No, I'm just worried that it's giving me too much of a peek behind the scenes before I get so to you see would, like, you would, the real you, meat of the story.
So you want to read this someday, but you might have rather read it after the movie.
Yeah, like if I wanted more out of the story after seeing the film, I would definitely pick this up. But having seen it now, it feels like, oh, well, they've had to kind of explain, well, in case you don't understand what's going on in the movie, this is where it comes from. And like, if the movie can't do that,
I think it's a completely different medium. It's adding spice to your steak, as opposed to the movie is just a steak.
I mean, it's definitely a gamble to give away parts of the story, parts of the universe. I mean, they're going to have to explain what the Pons Bridge is, the mind bridge between the Jaegers and the pilots in the movie. Because if they were just like, we jump in and we hook in and there we go, it's like it's going to be a little bit... It's not going to be clean enough. It's not going to have enough information. People are going to wonder how that works. And so there are things that are explained in this in detail that'll probably be skimmed over in the movie. And honestly, yeah. I think that's really the only thing that I'm thinking, like, oh, great, I get to hear them give a whole spiel about how that works again in the movie.
F*** you, love.
Yeah.
Forever alone.
Take that, love.
But other than that, I can't really see. Like, I don't agree. I'm glad that I saw this first. I feel like I got to see, you know, the first movie that maybe isn't as much of an incredible climax and exciting finish point as the movie itself.
It'll be interesting tomorrow night when we do it for the four of us that have read the book.
Yeah. And then John.
Like John Foltz, who has not read it, in his take, and Dustin, who hasn't read it, in his take.
Right, yeah. Right.
So it'll be so come back and listen to the Panamanga one.
Yeah, that should be out Friday morning. Right. Well, last Friday. It'll be out by the time this is up.
Yeah, a review it's of the movie. Up.
Yes,
it's already up, by the way.
We are talking to you from the past.
Internet time. Gotta go back in
time. So do
we
want to go around and give reviews?
I'm going to give it a solid 4 out of 5 stars. Definitely buy it if you're interested in some more Pacific Rim.
Totally. Kaiju action.
I'd say 3.5. I actually texted John the very last panel and went, is this the end of it? Because I was like, is this how it ends? But I enjoyed all aspects of it. I really enjoyed the story. And so, you know, I definitely would recommend it. It was good.
Yeah. You know, I'm going to go ahead and give it 3.5 out of 5. I think I really liked it a lot. And I like it a lot more now that we've talked it out. And I no longer feel like it's the power of love is what makes the Jaegers work. Shit. Sorry about that. I sound like such an angry hater.
Well, I mean, I think you're used to Jaeger first, then love.
Yes. So 3.5 out of 5 for me.
I think I'm just going to stick with a 2 out of 5 for me, because
I'm going to start calling you the fucking battle axe, dude. I swear to God.
He's nothing compared to Pink.
No wonder Vicious, man. You call him Vicious.
You know, some of the parts of the story seemed a little bit hokey.
The love parts.
Well, no, like the part where they're in like the spiritual mind world together and having like a makeout session.
And they're like, oh, it's
come on. There's so many more tasteful.
I can just
ways
imagine Joe
that.
Sitting there reading the book, just being like, "What the fuck?"
No, I am an awful romantic, but that was just cheesy as fuck.
Oh, and my best part was that they're like, it doesn't count. It's not real. We can do what we want here. It's like that's still cheating.
Yeah. But it's real to me.
But you're in different zip codes.
I remember when Cyclops and Emma Frost had that same discussion in an issue of X-Men.
Oh, really?
Whoa.
Nice. Full circle.
Yeah. See, it's kind of already been done, kind of a little bit.
A little hokey. Yeah. A little agreeable. Agreeable. Yeah. It's a little hokey. Yeah.
We'll see. We'll see.
Yeah.
I'm really interested to see how they do that in the movie. Yep. Because there's very definitely a cyber sex moment in this where they're like two glowing ethereal bodies talking to each other in this like bright white yellow plane.
I could just imagine in the middle of the fucking city, some kid looking up and being like, "Daddy, what is the robot doing?" And having the robot mean all like stroking some invisible phallus, you know, and all of a sudden, like,
that's,
you know,
that's really horrible.
The son, like, the dad just takes his hand and puts it over the son's eyes, and he's malfunctioning.
And then the giant reactor cannon fires.
Yes, yes, yes.
Takes down
power up.
What did you do to the Empire State Building? We sealed it in a magical, impenetrable
cocoon of love.
Cocoon, yes.
Cocoon of love.
Oh, it's...
That building is safe. Because I ain't fucking touching it.
Kaijus just go back into the ocean to wash themselves.
They're like, nah, I'm all right. I'm out.
Must get
people
clean.
Are perverts. All right. Well.
All right. Well, that is Pacific Rim for you guys.
And that's how I felt about it.
We are going to take a short interlude, and we will be back in just a few moments with talking about Godzilla, Gangsters, and Goliaths.
Hey, this is JP.
And Joe.
From the Geek Life Podcast on Panamanga.com. You can come check us out every week. We talk about comics, and more comics. Also, we talk about games.
Movies.
Zombie survival. And comics.
And comics.
So it's a weekly podcast. We try and get as much comics crammed in there as well, and then also enjoy some just geeky subjects and fun stuff. We've got lots of really cool people that come on the podcast and help host and guest speak and all that fun stuff. And we have a lot of fun, and hopefully you'll enjoy us too. You can check us out at podcast.pandamanga.com. Follow us on Tumblr at pandamanga.tumblr.com. Follow us on Twitter at IndieComics4all, and on Facebook at facebook.com/pandamangacomics. Come check us out. Hopefully you guys like us.
Hey, this is Justin with askametalhead.com, your metal education. The show is me and my kids. We talk a lot about metal, the shows that we go to, and we recently brought in a new host. His name's Brian, good friend of mine. We used to play in a band together. So we talk about metal and life in general, and occasionally we throw in some stuff about gaming because we're all gaming geeks and, you know, some of the movies that we go to. But really the show is about metal, music, all genres. Everybody's accepted except for Nickelback. So if you want to check us out and get your metal education on, ask a question, find some answers, or just hear some really good music, you can check us out at www.askametalhead.com. You can find us on iTunes as well. We're also followable at twitter.com/askametalhead, and you can check us out on Facebook at facebook.com/askametalhead. If you happen to be a Redditor, we also have a subreddit. And of course, surprise, surprise, that's reddit.com/r/askametalhead.
Welcome back to 4J's and a Comic, where we're getting ready to talk about Godzilla. Is a little history, as I like to do, because I'm a nerd. Godzilla comics have been published since about 1977, when Marvel did a 24-issue run called Godzilla, King of the Monsters, where Godzilla was actually entered into the Marvel Universe. It was S.H.I.E.L.D. tracking him.
Seriously? It, yeah. That's awesome.
Met up with the Fantastic Four, Spider-Man.
Wow.
And wow. That went to about 1979. Pretty fun stuff. It was, as a six-year-old, I loved it. It sure, probably won't...
Spider-Man versus Godzilla.
Yeah.
Come on. That's awesome.
That's something you talk about in the playground.
That's the sort of thing, like, there's so many, you always ask somebody, who do you think would win? So-and-so and so-and-so. Now it's like, who do you think would win? Anybody or
Godzilla. That's awesome.
In the mid-80s, it moved over to Dark Horse, where they published on and off for about 12 years. The highlights of it was a 17-issue ongoing series and the absolute absurd Godzilla versus Charles Barkley.
What?
If any of you are old enough to remember that commercial from like 92, they actually did a spinoff comic of it.
Shit.
Wow. I don't remember that. Was it a Taco Bell commercial where Godzilla steals his tacos awesome. Or something?
It was a Nike commercial, at least.
Oh my God.
Amazing.
Oh, man. I think I have a vague memory of
it. Is all of Charles Barkley's text in the comic book like thubba 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 thubba?
We should totally try and find that and like put it in the show notes.
it's available online.
On YouTube?
Yeah.
Sweet.
And then in 2010, IDW has taken over the publishing rights for it. And they have done basically three different ongoing series. They each last about a dozen issues. So about a year's worth. So season one, season two, season three, which just started last week. And they've also done about three different tie-in miniseries, not set in the continuity, but telling Godzilla stories. And we are going to be reviewing one of them tonight with Godzilla, Gangsters, and Goliaths. One of the interesting things that I told Justin earlier was, did you catch who wrote that?
I said, no, man. Yeah. And why is that even important to me? Like, I don't care, right?
Like, I don't give a shit. It was a Godzilla. I didn't care. But it was written by John Layman, who's doing a book called Chew, which was actually what got Justin in here to
start.
Yeah,
and I fucking love Chew. I think it's one of the best story, you know, starts that I've ever read. And it's funny because, you know, I was thinking, like, what's the thing that you could do that no other comic book has ever, like, what superpower can you have that has never existed anywhere else, right? And it's like the ability to eat somebody. And like,
right? Is that what that's about?
Yeah, dude, Chew is the great. It's so good. Chew is so good that I think I read the first book and then I bought the 31 after. I just bought
it. Sounds really
like
dark.
No questions asked. It's funny. And
it sounds like it's going to be like the pitch for a Chuck Palahniuk movie.
It's really, I mean, we're getting off topic, but it's really well written.
I'm doing a review on it down the road. Yeah, awesome. You guys will really love it.
The art is phenomenal. It's really well drawn. It's really well, I mean, and you know, there's meaningful things that happen in the world.
It's exciting that the same writer worked on this.
Right, and that was I was like, what? Like, really? Oh, sweet. Like, I didn't know that. And that made me like it even more because I like this story. So
basically, it's a Godzilla title, pretty much in name only. There's giant monsters, Godzilla's in it. And it had a very Asian John Woo cinema type feel to it, where
gangster feel.
Right.
We have a detective officer Soto. We open up seeing him shot and basically thrown off a boat, and he wakes up
on the shore of Monster Island,
which has this awesome 2-page spread.
Oh my god, there's so many good spreads
of all the Godzilla and Rodan and Mothra.
All just chilling.
All on Monster Island, and so the only way he can survive is to swim to Monster Island to get away. And there's this great sequence where he's running through the jungle, and the people that are after him are chasing him, and he stops and sees Godzilla. So what does he do? Throws a stick at Godzilla and runs the other way for then Godzilla to get pissed off. And,
like a little tiny stick.
And Godzilla has a temper problem. Yeah,
and Godzilla's like, flee.
Right. While he's on Monster Island, he encounters the Elias, which are
the two little chicks in the box.
Yeah, the little fairies that talk to and control Mothra. So his idea is, I'm going to get revenge on this person. I'm going to steal these guys.
Yeah, the gangster Takahashi, who basically runs Tokyo gangs.
Right.
Or runs Tokyo crime, essentially. He's been able to just squeeze all of the crime families and everybody under his banner. Yeah.
But as
sort of like the kaiju of crime.
Right. Yeah.
But as part
he even calls himself that. I am Dai Kaiju.
Yeah, right. As part of this, though, really, he's also being accused of killing his partner. So you kind of get the sense early on that he's this bad, like he's a bad cop or whatever, but that kind of gets fleshed out as well that he didn't, and that's part of.
He's very grizzled.
Right.
Yeah. There's definitely a lot of darkness in his character.
He's
estranged from his sons.
He's
obsessed with his job. He, you know, to the point of putting himself and his partner in danger against really an enemy, a mob boss, basically, who is way beyond his ability.
You get the feeling that those two are the only clean police officers in Tokyo, and everyone else is on.
There's an amazing amount of parallels. I mean, you talk about he's this little guy going up against this huge, you know, sort of mob boss, right?
Yeah.
And then you have these huge, giant kaiju. You've got Mothra, who's a giant moth, and you've got Godzilla, which is obviously Godzilla. There's this whole theme of balance. You know, you have balance and chaos, and
cosmic balance.
Right, right. Yeah. If things get off by a little bit, then now you piss Godzilla off, right? You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, basically, if you have the monsters artificially intervene with the human world, then catastrophes will come. Right. And of course, in a Godzilla comic, catastrophe equal Godzilla.
Yeah.
Right, right.
I love the second issue where he's controlling Mothra, using Mothra to take out all these gangster...
Or escape jail, that's my favorite.
Yeah.
Or he's like, this is your last chance. I'm only giving you one chance to let me out of here.
Like, and
you dirty cops. And they're like, yeah, whatever. And then they close the door and you hear, ka-crash! And they open back up and it's just a giant hole with Mothra flying off. It's like, oh, snap, that's the best prison break ever.
Right, right. But I really liked that theme where the giant, you know, kaiju are controlled by the two, or, well, I don't want to say controlled, but they're balanced by these two little 7-inch or 8-inch girls.
Yeah, I mean, they basically allude to them being able to control Mothra, but they themselves, to use the same word again, allude to the fact that it's a much more complicated relationship than humans are capable of understanding.
It's yin-yang. There's a lot of yin-yang.
Yeah,
right?
And they say, like, we basically do control Mothra, but we don't really.
Right.
But it's more complicated than that.
It's almost like
more or less.
We can infer some suggestion to Mothra. Sure. We can, you know, but we don't. So we have influence over, but we don't control.
Yeah, I like how Mothra was really its own character.
Yeah.
Because at one point, he uses the Elias to, in turn, use Mothra to do his bidding a little bit early on, which sounds dark, but really he's trying to do good.
Right.
And then the Elias start to go like, nah, we're going to.
We're done.
We're done.
Yeah, we're done helping you.
And then he says, I want an audience with Mothra. I wanted to make my case. And there's just this amazing scene where he's standing on the top of the skyscraper and Mothra's floating in front of him. And he's like, join me or kill me.
Yeah, help
Make
me or kill
your
me.
Choice. Right. And next thing you know, Mothra's blowing shit up for him.
Right, right.
Yeah.
It's almost as if Mothra is, in a way, like has a moral detector.
Yeah.
Yeah, you sort of kidnapped the Elias to get control of me. But deep down.
Admit that, all right. So Tokyo's balance wasn't right, and this stuff needed to happen, but no, that's enough.
Yeah, we're done helping balance, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, he goes a little bit too far, and, you know, somebody woke the Hulk.
Godzilla.
Right.
And then the gangster...
Takahashi
gains control of the Elias, and that's when Godzilla shows up.
Right.
Which was this great scene...
Oh, my gosh.
...of Officer Soto in this apartment building... And he looks out the window to see Godzilla's eyes staring in.
Right? Yeah. So awesome. I love how later on he's like after Takahashi has the Elias and Soto is all depressed and sad and he's sitting in this bar just drinking himself into oblivion.
Watching,
and then continually looks over his right shoulder out the window to see like Mothra and Rodan and all the monsters just like
it's just
destroying
chaos.
The thing. Like, yeah. I mean, they could have just turned and been on him in 2 seconds. And he's just like watching. It's like, yeah, give me some more Jaeger.
Yeah. It's the apocalypse going on outside.
Did
the
anybody
window.
Get that? No.
Right. Yeah,
yeah, I did. Okay. Yeah, I got it.
Because what else?
I'll take a Jaeger bomb.
Jaeger.
I'll take a Jaeger bomb over
which
here.
Actually leads to Soto, whose son just happens to work for the Mechagodzilla program.
Or used to.
Well, you know,
one of them does.
Yeah.
He's kind of like a MacGyver. He can fix anything, right? That's kind of how he gets introduced. Like, why do you waste your time working on these old piece of crap cars when you...
Right, he works for street racers. He tunes street racers. And then the other brother, because he's estranged from both of the sons.
Right.
So one of them is a street racer mechanic, and then the other actually works for the military.
In the Mechagodzilla
program. In the Mechagodzilla program, evidently.
He's like a pilot.
Or the decommissioned Mechagodzilla, whatever.
Right.
So let's go steal Mechagodzilla to get the Elias back. That scene was so great.
They're flying over the city with Mechagodzilla.
Right.
What's up? And they literally drop down on Godzilla and be like, what's up? Stop causing trouble. Yeah,
so
that was
so good. It was still John Finch's line. So good.
It is so good.
So good. Once it hits your lips, it's so good. Once Godzilla touched down in the middle of Tokyo, it was so good.
There were so many freaking amazing scenes of destruction in the city. It reminded me of Katsuhiro Otomo's book,
Akira, which anybody who's a serious Japanese comic fan, at least, and a lot of people who aren't, know about Akira. The Akira comic books are hands down some of the most fantastic. Why did I go Southern there?
That was fantastic.
That's how good they were.
Yeah. No, they are.
They're so good they make you Southern.
Yeah. They were finger licking.
Just want to have them some sweet tea and some
some sweet what?
Sweet tea.
And
some boiled peanuts. All right. Anyway, that was boiled peanuts.
Somebody's gonna write a comic with. Godzilla shows up in Georgia. Throw peaches at him.
Anyway, Akira is extremely good. Extremely good. I mean, it's like, what, 6 or 9 volumes? It's huge.
Six big phone book size volumes. Yeah,
fatty volumes. No, I mean, the movie doesn't even become close to telling the story. It's like maybe the first third. Anyway, fantastic. And there's a lot of amazing scenes of destruction in the middle of these huge skyscrapers. And the detail on the destroyed cities in Akira is amazing. And this, I would say, rivals and in some places is more impressive. Because there's so much detail there. The skyscrapers with all their little tiny little windows and stuff. Because they're doing something on such a large scale with these massive kaiju monsters. That's a little redundant, I guess. But with these massive kaiju that are just out there destroying things, and they're so big. And so instead of the little fine detail being grass and trees, the little fine detail is buildings and streets and lamps and they didn't get wires. Lazy with it. No, they didn't. There's so much detail. It's beautiful.
The artist on it was named Alberto Ponticelli.
Masterful.
Yeah, very, very good.
Masterful. You know, I liked sorry, go ahead.
I still remember one panel where it's Godzilla just walking down the street and like turning his head to the side and blowing a just perfect hole through the middle of a building, and the like fire blast coming out of his mouth at like the exact angle, and it just looks like, I didn't like that room, so I got rid of it right there.
One thing that I thought was interesting was, well, they did variant covers. I think, what, 3 on each?
Yeah, that's generally the IDW's thing. They do usually two regular covers and one in 10 cover.
And the rare cover was actually a black and white, just the inks for one of the two normal covers. And I can remember thinking to myself, wow, what a cool peek behind the curtain. And also, thank God it got colored, because it's so unbelievably full of detail that without the color to kind of color code it and break it and like compartmentalize it in my mind, that like this is brown and all that is one thing and this is green and all that is one thing.
And some depth too.
Yeah, it was so hard to understand what's going on. And it's not because the drawing is lacking in any way. It's because the drawing is so incredibly detailed that it needs to have the color involved to make it make sense. And it's just masterful. Really impressive. Really impressive drawing. I was right away blown away. And I'll continue my rant real quick. Speaking of going from large scale down to small scale, the way that they drew the faces and did the detail on faces, instead of a couple careful hash marks here and there to suggest depth and wrinkles and things like that and age.
Or like the scar on the back, like I can't remember his name, the bad guy. He's got this scar.
Takahashi scar.
Takahashi,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, there is very, very bold pen strokes all over the faces that almost look like squiggly lines that work really well. When I first saw that, I thought to myself, that looks just messy and goofy, and that's awesome. That is awesome. I didn't even finish thinking that's shitty. I saw it and thought to myself, that's awesome. That is awesome. And I was perpetually impressed that they were able to have so many lines on a face. Dark lines, not little hash marks, not little suggestions of something, but just like freaking lines on the face, and still have it be clean and make sense and expressive somehow. And it didn't end up looking messy. It ended up looking gnarly and grizzled and dark and almost noir in a way. It was awesome.
It had a very noirish feel.
Yeah, didn't it? Yeah, it was so good.
Yeah, between all the dark, like grisly lines and then the really gangster vengeance storyline, there was a really deep undercurrent of noir themes.
Yeah, that's absolutely. Absolutely.
I'd read this a couple years ago when it came out, and one of the good things about us doing this podcast is I get to revisit things that I really liked in the past. Mm-hmm. And when I was doing my reread, I was like, I hope I liked it again the second time around as I did the first, and I thought it held up really, really well.
I thought it was refreshing for a kaiju story to not be really about the kaiju.
Yeah.
Yeah. That like, what else is going on while the monsters are sacking Tokyo?
It made me kind of think of Gotham Central, where instead of it's always Batman, 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 whenever you think Gotham, it's like, no, Gotham Central is like, there are other people in Gotham. There are a police force. There is a police force that is constantly having to not only put up with all the crazy bullshit that that Batman seems to drag into the city, but also be supported by Batman. And it's like, there's a rich other side to things. And I think that is one thing that really stood out to me in this, is I really liked them investigating the little people, literally, in comparison to, you know, it's just the story of the military trying to destroy this big monster that's smashing their city. That seems to be a repetitive theme in those kind of big stories. And it's kind of freaking awesome that they were like, hey, check this out. There's actually gangsters in Tokyo, and because they live in a world where it's like, yeah, common knowledge that there's a freaking island full of these badass monsters, and like, how that knowledge being just normal interacts with the rest of that and changes the way that those guys go about their business. It's freaking awesome.
I really liked at the end of the last issue when they said, Tokyo rebuilds like it always does.
Like it always does.
Like it always will.
Like it always does. Period. Like it always will. Yeah. Period. Like that was
really cool. We're in this world, they're literally, the kaiju are these giant forces of nature. Kind of like where we live in Northern California, we have earthquakes every so often.
Right. Part is a fact of life. The kaiju are a fact of life in this world. Yeah.
But there was some great other, I mean, there was these amazing themes about, again, balance and redemption to a certain degree, right? There's several.
It was a rich story.
You know, there's a lot of that. And, you know, he redeems himself with the police by proving that he didn't kill his partner. His, you know, he sort of redeems himself with his kids at the end, towards the end, which is, I think, is a really endearing, you know, there's this very endearing story where now he's very estranged. At the beginning of the story, he's estranged from his kids, and now they're going out of their way to visit him, and which I thought was really cool. And I like that Godzilla was incidental. He wasn't the main plot point in the story. A line gets crossed. And then it that brings the, yeah, that's sort of like, okay, this is the consequence, right? Is the chaos. And so that's what I thought was the coolest about all of this.
That Godzilla wasn't just, hey, Godzilla's smashing the city, let's do something about it. It was, this is why Godzilla came.
Right.
There's a reason behind it. He is a servant of balance in nature.
Exactly.
Is how it came across.
So you have Mothra, who is sort of the peace side of things, right?
And it makes me want to watch more of the movies and get to know the mythos more, because there was so much stuff that this almost assumed you already knew. And you had to just kind of glean or just roll with.
I didn't know that Mothra was sort of like,
me neither.
Quote fingers, good guy.
But it seems like Mothra comes across as subduing the other kaiju on a regular basis in this book anyway. And I would imagine it's very much like that in the movies. Yeah. Which I don't know enough about. One of my closest friends, her son, Noah, is obsessed with Godzilla, like to a point of ridiculousness. I mean, it's great. It's completely great. I encourage it as much as I possibly can.
Yeah, if he were on this podcast tonight, he would blow us out of the water with his Godzilla speak.
We actually are toying with the idea of having him on the Pacific Rim review.
Well, that'll be fun.
Yeah, he's going to be going with us tomorrow, and so hopefully we can get him on there and get his excited 10-year-old.
How old is he?
10.
Oh, we're going to have to keep the rimming jokes to a minimum then. Damn it. I have them all written down in order.
Well, anyway, we'll see. I'm not really sure if that's going to happen, but it would be pretty cool to get his perspective.
We're going to have like a whole row in that theater.
Yeah. We really are.
I'm bringing my kids.
We have to come early.
We're going to have to book a section.
Yes. That's what we should do. Call ahead.
Yes.
Back to the gangsters and Goliaths.
All right. Well, we've examined this quite thoroughly. Anyone have any final thoughts on Godzilla, Gangsters, and Goliaths?
It makes me want to read more Godzilla comics.
It kind of does.
Yeah, you know, I was going to say that.
I had assumed Godzilla comics were shallow.
Yeah,
and it just for
smash.
Right, and I had no idea. And actually, as I was walking into the back to set up the podcast in Waterfront Comics today, I thought to myself, "Wow, I really need to pick up some more Godzilla comics." And then I looked over on the magazine wall, and there's like a G-Fan magazine. Is it a Godzilla fan magazine?
It's a Godzilla fan magazine. Coming out for like
How often does it come out?
It comes out like every 2 months.
That's amazing. That's amazing. I now see. All right, I'm finding myself more and more endeared to the whole Godzilla thing, because I had kind of always assumed that it was really shallow.
Yeah.
And I was always I know, I always just kind of like wrote off Noah going, and then Mothra shows up, and then this happens, and then it's just,
I think
like,
it's really fun for younger kids like that.
Yeah.
You know, you know, the idea of giant monsters and taking back to our earlier Pacific Rim discussion, you know, seeing a kid playing with a giant monster versus a giant robot.
Right,
you know,
exactly.
Right.
It's right in their wheelhouse.
It comes and talks to that little kid. I can remember just the other day I was talking to my cousin, and I said, hey, we're going to go see Pacific Rim on Thursday. And he said, what's that? And I said, a giant monsters and robots. He's like, that sounds awesome.
How old's your cousin, John?
How old's my cousin? He's my age.
Okay.
Just a full-grown adult man. And pretty much if you talk to any guy and you go, giant monsters and robots, they go, deal.
Sign me up.
Sign me up.
When we were kids, we had Voltron. We had Ultraman. We had, what was the other Voltron? It was...
We had the car Voltron and the lion Voltron.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I remember, not to totally sidetrack us, but I remember when my buddy Paul brought the very first GoBot to show and tell.
Yes.
And he opens that thing up, and it was like third grade. Every third grader in that classroom's jaw hit the desk simultaneously at once, and everybody wanted one. There was, for a moment, no more Star Wars. There was no more. It was just, oh my God, what did that car just do? It turned into a robot? Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
That exists? Yeah. That happens?
Yeah.
And so, I mean, you know, now...
Have you seen the Japanese toy, or speaking of anime stuff, you know, the Robotech and the Veritech fighters that changed a jet to a half jet, half robot to a robot? They have 2 foot tall ones that actually do all that.
Yeah. And they're models too,
and
right?
They're gorgeous. Yeah. But they're really expensive,
yes,
but they're,
they are.
It would be so sick to have one of those. So back on point. Any final thoughts?
I would agree. It would make me want to read more Godzilla, only if the story is as good as, and I know you can't have it exactly consistent across the board, but if it's not, you know, again, if it's not just Godzilla,
if it doesn't have that human element that this one so clearly had.
Put in a little plug, another miniseries that IDW published, Godzilla Half Century War, was also very excellent. And I highly recommend that.
I read the first issue of that, and the art, oh my God.
I mean, if you thought Gangsters and Goliath had highly detailed art, this one, it's super mega detailed art. That's what James Doki is known for.
Kaiju. It's massively monstrously detailed art. Nice.
Yes. Yeah, I would definitely want to read more, as long as it doesn't go like way too far in the direction of Godzilla Smash, and that, or doesn't go like trying to get away from it too much and go to
Well, in your
Godzilla
experience, John, have you read a couple of the other ones, and does it consistently have this sort of a interest level, or does it get really
simple? The miniseries do. The ongoings have, to me, just had a problem because it became more Godzilla Smash, Godzilla Fight, a different monster. Mm-hmm. But the two miniseries, the Gangsters and Goliaths and Half Century War, I thought were, you know, amazing with, you know, 5-6 issues, you know, and you can tell a complete story and be done with
it. It's a complete thought. They're not trying to ongoingly stretch it out. And
it actually felt like a movie on paper.
That's awesome.
Both of them.
I would love to see this as a movie.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
I think
you
got to
love gangster movies, giant monsters. Come on.
Oh, yeah. I think that would be my only complaint about this whole storyline, was that it felt like they wrapped up a little bit too fast. Mm. It wrapped up and I was sort of like, well, they kind of came to a quick, like they got through that quickly.
Yeah.
And, you know, not that I need them to drag it on forever, but certainly I felt like, they really concluded quickly, but I'm kind of nitpicking, honestly.
Shit got so far out of hand that like there was no... at all anybody's alive anymore way to resolve that.
Yeah, once you destroy Tokyo, I mean, you kind of have to resolve it.
I loved how the big gangster boss at the end was taken out.
Oh, yeah.
That put, like, the biggest smile on my face the whole times I read it. Like, I'm the biggest monster of them all. Squeak.
And I love that.
Toe Jam.
Every time he's giving his big, like, villain soliloquy, that behind him, there's a freaking kaiju about to smash.
Right.
It reminded me, do you remember in GoldenEye when Boris is like, I'm invincible, and he stands up and then he just gets sprayed by coolant and just dies? It's like, that's right.
Sure, yeah.
All right, everybody, ratings?
Oh man, 4 for me. I really like this one a lot.
Yeah. Totally blindsided by it.
Totally. I was not expecting to like it, and I liked it a lot.
Godzilla was never really something that I was a big fan of when I was a kid. It looked too cheap to me. The Godzilla that I remember was big rubber foot smashing down on a little plastic house, and it was so obvious.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And so it wasn't something that I don't want to say I begrudgingly read this, but as I started to read it, I was like, this is really good.
Right.
I mean, I'm easily a 4 on this.
And that's what I was going for when I recommended it to everybody, because it was something that everyone's like, okay, a Godzilla book, all right. But then,
we all felt like, okay, John, we'll do a Godzilla book because Pacific Rim's coming out,
right?
Yeah, but I'm really looking for
it'll be relevant,
right? Exactly, and I liked it more than the Pacific Rim. Book.
I did too.
Easy 4, definitely.
Yeah,
John, what do you think?
Again, a solid 4 and a half. You know, it was a very fun. Mm-hmm. It's a book if you want to read, if you want to have fun, and that's what I hope people start getting more out of comics is, you know, it doesn't have to be so serious. You can actually have a book that's really fun. And well, that will wrap up Godzilla. A couple of final notes. If you want more kaiju, there's a really cool Kickstarter out there called World War Kaiju. It has about a month left to run. At the time of this recording. The art that I've seen looks phenomenal. The creative team had done a hardcover called Titanium Rain, which we have in stock, which had amazing art, and this kaiju one also has amazing art. So give that a check out on Kickstarter. And that's pretty much all I have to say about kaiju for tonight. Next week, we're going to be reviewing a couple of Marvel comics. We're going to be reviewing The Amazing Hawkeye, the two graphic novels that have come out.
So good.
Matt Fraction
and a host of talented artists. And
chiefly David Aja.
David Aja.
Yeah.
And then we're also going to be talking about one of the most surprising books I've read, The Lethal Foes of Spider-Man. I expected nothing from this book.
Was it Superior or Lethal?
Yeah, Lethal Foes of Superior Spider...
I think it's Superior Foes.
Yeah, of Superior Foes of...
The old title was Lethal Foes.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. The Superior Foes of Spider-Man is what it's called. Mm-hmm. And I had no desire to even read what this book was till I heard about on Twitter the amazing reviews it got, and it's probably one of my favorite books I've read this year.
Yeah, well, I remember when you told me about it before we were even talking about reviewing it. You had recommended it and said, knowing you, John, this is your kind of humor. You're going to like this. And you were completely right. I was cracking up. It has a kind of Watchmen-ish sort of feel. Like, you know what I mean? Like The Watchmen, where, I mean, nowhere near as heavy as that is. But it has that kind of peek behind the curtain, you know, sitting around and snarkily talking about what's going on and like the lives of people who really do put a costume on and go out there and try and fight or make crime. I think its candor took me off guard. I was not expecting that at all, because so much of the in-between stuff of the, all right, now I got to go buy a new costume, or, oh, man, I got hurt, or, oh, man, somebody got to bail me out from jail, and that sort of stuff. Like,
right,
it's glossed over in superhero books, and in this, it's in painstaking, hilarious detail.
Yeah, the superhero is in the periphery.
Yeah, so I'm looking forward to talking more about that.
Tune in next week for that.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, wrapping this up, I'm John from Waterfront Comics. Thank you guys for listening.
See you guys next time.
Later. Everybody's accepted except for Nickelback. You can check us out at askametalhead.com. I like that, but
that's awesome.
I think that works.
Except for fucking Nickelback.